Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm your host, Lucia Starbuck. The name refers to the fact that the state isn't red or blue, it's both. Today, for the first time since we extended the show to 30 minutes, we'll feature just one guest, Nevada's Democratic Attorney General, Aaron Ford. We'll get into the legislation he's advocating for this session and the lawsuits he's filed to challenge President Donald Trump and his administration. But first, I want to thank all of the listeners who submitted questions, some of which I was able to share out loud with the AG. So let's get to it. Thank you so much for joining me, Attorney General Ford. Now for the third time you've been on Purple Politics Nevada.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's always great to hear from your listeners and to have a conversation with you about this.
Let's start with the legislation that you're proposing this session. One would be to prohibit what you're calling price fixing of essential goods. Lots of concerned business owners saying, are they going to be penalized for simply raising their prices just to survive? How do you define price fixing?
Your question about price fixing is a great one. It arises out of a bill that my office has sponsored, Assembly Bill 44, which touches on a very important subset of price fixing in the area of essential goods and ensuring that we have a fair playing field where companies are not cheating by working among themselves to artificially increase the price of an essential good beyond the normal practices of supply and demand. And so Assembly Bill 44 makes the manipulation of the price of an essential good or service a violation of our Nevada Unfair Trade Practices Act. Nevadans are struggling to stay afloat, and they're finding that the perpetually rising cost of their basic needs is unaffordable. It's housing, household utilities, ground transportation, phone, internet access. I understand that there were some concerns raised by certain business interests. And what I will say is that they need to fear not, because this only addresses those who are cheating, those who are utilizing unlawful and unfair means and business practices to artificially raise and increase the cost of essential goods beyond the normal workings of supply and demand.
How do you calculate that supply and demand? I want to play one of our first questions from listener Anthony Zarnick. We'll hear from him right now.
AG Ford, you filed lawsuits claiming price gouging. How does Nevada law define that? And how does it differ from the whatever the traffic will bear ethos of capitalism?
Thank you for the question. And first, let me draw a distinction between price gouging, which this bill does not address, and price fixing. So price gouging is something that happens, generally speaking, in the course of a new state of emergency. In fact, my office did pass a law that outlaws price gouging when we have a state of emergency that has been declared in Nevada. And we did that because we saw a lot of people artificially, not people, but entities and businesses artificially inflating the price of goods and services because they knew they essentially had a captive market and they were able to hike up prices and they were able to gouge consumers. Now, you should be price gouging, period. But to be sure, the price gouging law that we pass only comes into existence when we have a declared state of emergency. This bill is distinctly different. It focuses on, again, manipulation of the market in the context of a company or companies conspiring to artificially increase the amount of goods or services, essential goods or services, or, you know, one entity that might be using an algorithm, for example, to get a rate that's going throughout the community and utilizing that information to cheat and artificially increase the price of an essential good or service. And that's what this bill focuses on.
If this bill passes, and as your office would do these investigations, like, what would raise a red flag? What would be a knowingly manipulative move?
It's going to be a case-by-case scenario, looking at the price of essential goods and services over a five-year period and ascertain if we see an increase that is above that average, so to speak, and then looking into what has caused that raise. Again, if it is a fact of supply and demand where, for example, in the case of tariffs, which are affecting what's happening in Nevada, that is something that would not weigh into a negative calculation against an entity that may very well be responding to the laws of supply and demand.
During the hearing, a couple examples were thrown out. You and your colleague said that raising the price of eggs wouldn't count, but maybe housing in response to the LA fires would. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
In the housing context, I'll just say in Nevada, we have received reports about certain companies that are conspiring, allegedly, I should say, conspiring with other housing complexes to artificially increase, using algorithms, artificially increase the price of rent. You know, it doesn't just apply to housing. Again, it wouldn't apply to eggs in a circumstance because we know that there was, in fact, a shortage of eggs because of the bird flu. And so again, case-by-case analysis, you know, we will look at those with the eye toward protecting the consumer.
And another one of your bills kind of getting dragged through the mud by the opposition. Your Youth Online Safety Act would protect kids on social media through verifying age, prohibiting notifications during the school day, and disabling some functions like autoplay videos and live streaming. How will this protect kids on social media?
We view that as a very important bill. And, you know, look, I wouldn't call it being dragged through the mud. The legislative process is one that requires compromise. It requires individuals having conversations. There are two prongs of protecting youth that I'm trying to get at with Senate Bill 63. And the first of which is predation. I was just talking to an investigator today who was about to engage in what we call John Stings, where individuals are trying to prey upon children and they're utilizing digital platforms in order to lure these kids into a circumstance where they can ultimately take advantage of them. And we want to cut down on that. And we know that it is happening in almost every single digital platform you can contemplate. The second focus of the bill is the mental health component. It's a foregone conclusion that the mental health concerns that are arising out of what's happening in social media are there, and we want to try to minimize those. And so ensuring that we have the ability to allow parents to restrict certain engagement, whether it is, for example, receiving notifications between the hours of midnight and six when kids should be sleeping, no notifications during school hours. The age verification component is an important one, but it is not one that is a requirement for the bill to pass, frankly. I mean, we are, again, looking at opportunities to improve the health and safety and the benefit of youth in the state. And if that means we got to take a step back and take one small step forward as opposed to the full bill, we're open to doing that.
During that testimony, you had a really heartbreaking hearing from a mom who had lost her daughter because her daughter had consumed content online that gave her guidance on how to commit suicide. You mentioned that you're like not targeting the content. So like, how would this protect kids and how would it keep them off of these algorithms that feed them this really negative and harmful content?
Well, you're right. We're not targeting content. And that's one of the ways in which we know that this bill is going to survive constitutional attacks or scrutiny and litigation, because we're focusing on the ways in which these algorithms are operating. The example you gave, when the police found her daughter, they saw the particular digital device still running examples on how to commit suicide. And so it's that autoplay, that doom scrolling component that we believe this bill would have affected that particular circumstance at a minimum.
Is there any path forward to try to regulate content? Or you said it's just there's just too many constitutional questions there.
Well, that's not my desire. And I'll leave that to others who want to explore that. I want to make it very clear that Senate Bill 63 has nothing to do with trying to regulate content. What we can do by the law is regulate the time, place, and manner of speech. And that's what we're doing in this bill. I think these are defensible in court, and we will prevail if we were to be challenged.
Moving a little away from the legislature, you have filed numerous lawsuits challenging President Donald Trump and his administration. I don't even think we have time to get to all of them today, but I believe it was one of your first, if not the first, to prevent the president from ending birthright citizenship. What alarm bells were going off in your mind?
Well, look, the last few months have seen a concerted attack on our rule of law, our constitutional principles, and on our system of checks and balances from those in Washington. We've seen the president attempt to unconstitutionally expand his power, to ignore congressional intent and government funding, and to attack and strip away rights of people in our country. And I understand that these actions have left many Americans concerned and worried. These are not issues that we expect to deal with in America, but we are. And these are not actions that are taken, generally speaking, by past presidents, but here we are. And what I have said is this: President Trump won the election. He is our president. I am not an election denier. Mr. Trump has every right to implement the platform and promises he made on the trail, but it must do so lawfully. And when he does not, I will meet him in court. It's a two-pronged test. Is he violating the law with the pronouncements and actions that he's taking? If he is, the next question I ask is it negatively affecting Nevadans? And if that's the case, then we will file suit. You asked about the very first one we filed, birthright citizenship. It was something that was on our radar already. Fellow Democratic attorneys general across the nation knew that he was already going to try to attack this. And so we had already been discussing among ourselves the approach we would take in defending it. I take it personal when he tried to undermine birthright citizenship. The last time a person born on this soil was denied birthright citizenship under the Constitution was the Dred Scott case, where descendants of African slaves were told by our U.S. Supreme Court, our court said Black people, descendants of slaves, not only were not citizens, but they could never be citizens under the Constitution. And it took the passage of the 14th Amendment to guarantee that African descendants of slaves born in this country would be given the rights of citizenship. And by a stroke of a pen, Mr. President is trying to undo the Constitution and to say that people born here are not citizens. And we sprung the action immediately. Mr. President violated the law 6 hours into his inauguration. 6 hours later, we were filing a lawsuit. And a few hours after that, we were prevailing in two different lawsuits we had filed. To be sure, we're going to have a Supreme Court argument on the breadth of what's called injunctive relief that we received. Can it be nationwide as opposed to only the states who file lawsuits? But we are confident that the president got it wrong there. He does not have the right to, by executive order, undo a constitutional protection. Now, he can't do it. What he has to do is go to Congress and get two-thirds of both chambers to say yes, and then go to the states and get three-fourths of the states to change the Constitution, and then he can accomplish his goal.
Immigration is a hot topic in the country and in Nevada. Recently, organizers canceled Immigrant Lobby Day at the legislature after ICE detained at least 30 immigrants in northern Nevada, including in Carson City. I received a couple questions from listeners about how the state can protect immigrants. This one is from Karina Black, the executive director of the Northern Nevada International Center.
Attorney General Ford, what measures will you take to add protections for immigrants and refugees in the state of Nevada? For example, prohibiting ICE to enter protected areas like schools and churches? Does AB 217 provide sufficient protections for these individuals?
And just for a bit of context, that bill would prohibit schools from allowing immigration officers on campus or to access student records without a warrant.
Well, I wouldn't be able to speak too much to AB 217. I understand the general proposition. Here's what I will say. Soon after the president, won the election, we began to hear and to see trepidation in the community. My office, on my own initiative, put out a statement, again, acknowledging that the president is the president and he has the right to pursue his policies, but it must do so lawfully. And in that regard, I acknowledge the fears of members of the community, whether they were LGBTQ members or members of the immigrant community. And subsequent to that, I put out Know Your Rights documents. Here's the deal. I am the attorney general for the entire state of Nevada. That means that I represent every person who lives in Nevada. Every person present in this country has constitutional rights. I didn't make that up. And it is my job as the top law enforcement officer in the state to protect the constitutional rights of every single person in this state to the best of my ability. I do not have authority in the immigration context. That's plenary authority that has been afforded by our Constitution to Congress and to the president. And so to the extent he is undertaking lawful actions, I can't do anything to intervene in that regard. But what I can do, again, is to remind folks that they have rights, which seems to me everybody in this state would want an attorney general who's standing up for the rights of everybody in this state.
You mentioned putting out the Know Your Rights information. You also clashed with Republican Governor Joe Lombardo about the role local agencies should play in immigration enforcement. You published the legislature-mandated model immigration policies, which essentially told schools, law enforcement, and healthcare facilities to limit helping federal immigration actions as much as they can under the law. Why put out that policy during this time?
I was required to develop, having consulted with stakeholder groups from across the state over the last few years, to put together a model immigration policy for schools, for hospitals, courthouses, and for law enforcement. I did my job. And so it was a manufactured fight, frankly, waged by the governor against me. I think he views this, and many view this, as a wedge issue where people can draw fire on one side or the other. But the fact is, again, I am the attorney general charged with upholding the law. There's other laws on the books, by the way, that date back to the early 1900s that say point blank that state law enforcement should refrain from doing immigration duties. And so at the end of the day, I believe that state monies should be spent on state resources, state issues. The people that I speak to in this state, they want our state money spent to improve our education system, to make housing attainable, to improve our mental health system, to protect our environment. That doesn't make us a sanctuary state. That makes us a sovereign. And I'm going to defend the sovereignty of this state.
Senate Minority Leader Robin Titus called on all Nevada law enforcement agencies to participate in the 287G agreement, which would enhance cooperation between local and federal agencies for immigration. What are your thoughts on this?
I'll leave that discussion to the legislators. The fact of the matter is the 287G program has been in litigation several times, and it has been found unconstitutional at certain times during this fight. Mr. Lombardo himself withdrew his metro from the 287G program. So, using the phraseology sanctuary state, it seems to me that he himself created a sanctuary jurisdiction by his own definition, I suspect. But I don't disagree with him on that particular issue, because at that time, there were cases saying that program was unconstitutional because it was holding people beyond the ability of the government to hold people without a judicial warrant. This conversation is something that's happening among legislators and happening at the federal level. But to the extent these programs violate the Constitution and negatively impact and affect Nevadans, it's my job as Attorney General to step in.
You're listening to Nevada Democratic Attorney General Aaron Ford right here on Purple Politics Nevada with yours truly, Lucia Starbuck, answering questions that were submitted by some of you, our KUNR listeners. Looking at the other lawsuits you filed, you've challenged the Department of Education's threat to withhold federal funding from states that refuse to abandon DEI programs. This next question is from Peter Skugel in Spring Creek.
My question for the Attorney General is, I noticed that he has joined the lawsuit against the Trump administration regarding defunding of DEI initiatives across the country. And my question is, what evidence is there of tangible benefits for students from DEI programs? And also, coupled with that, don't the equity aspects of these programs at least imply that minority students are not capable of fulfilling the standards that other students have to face?
Well, I appreciate the question. I've heard that question time and time again. Today, we use the phraseology diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. When I was going through undergraduate degree, we were using the phrase affirmative action. And those same arguments were used against affirmative action. An anecdote is not evidence. And there are studies that demonstrate the benefits of affirmative action programs and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs for not just minority members of our society, but the entirety of society. But let me tell you my personal story about this. I was in a program called Project Upward Bound. It was a federal program for high school students whose parents didn't go to college and could not afford to send their children to college. That program enabled me to stay out of trouble on Saturdays during the summers when a lot of my friends from the neighborhoods that I was growing up in were doing things that ultimately led to bad results. Instead, I was studying on Saturdays, taking extra classes, taking practice SAT tests, and it helped me to matriculate into Texas A&M University. I got admitted and I could not afford to go. In fact, I couldn't even afford the application fee. It was $25 back then. Project Upward Bound gave me a fee waiver that I included with my application when I moved to Texas A&M. That's the benefit of a program. And by the way, I mentioned that program because it's on the chopping block right now. Programs that help people move to the next station in life. But to the question about affirmative action, I got a scholarship to go to Texas A&M. It was an affirmative action scholarship designated for Black and Brown students who otherwise would not have been able to afford to go to college. I went to Texas A&M on an affirmative action scholarship and was sat next to students who always looked at me and said to me something to the effect of, you don't deserve to be here. You took somebody's spot. You know, you're not qualified. I would not have been able to not only matriculate into Texas A&M, but graduate from Texas A&M, but go on to get four other degrees. And I'm not saying it to brag. I'm saying that because I am living proof of equity programs that allow for opportunities for individuals who are already qualified. And now I have five degrees, including two master's degrees, my law degree, and my PhD. And I will swear by the benefit of affirmative action that allowed me the opportunity to now be here three decades later as Attorney General of the state of Nevada. That is a success story that is echoed and replicated all throughout the country.
Thank you for sharing your personal experience. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to talk about elections. You and Nevada Secretary of State Cisco Aguilar have teamed up to stop Trump's executive order to require proof of citizenship when registering to vote, stop mail-in ballots from being counted after Election Day, and his threat to withhold federal money for noncompliance. This next question is from Mike Escobar, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and a nonpartisan voter from Reno.
What sorts of challenges to Nevada elections do you anticipate coming as a result of the Trump mandates? And what do you feel Nevada's response should be regarding those mandates?
Well, thank you for that question. I think the response we've demonstrated, we sued President Trump because the Constitution is clear about the power to regulate elections. Again, the question is what he is doing unlawful? And if so, is it negatively affecting Nevadans? Both instances, the answer is yes. The Constitution is clear about who has the power to regulate elections. As sovereigns closest to the people, the states have that primary responsibility. Congress can preempt state election laws for federal contests, but nowhere does the Constitution provide the president or the executive branch with any independent power to modify the state's procedures for conducting federal elections. He's overstepping. The unconstitutional elections executive order, it targets the Election Assistance Commission, which is by design an independent bipartisan agency that Congress established. It also required the commission to make its decisions under standards of bipartisanship and collaboration with the states, which actually administer the nation's elections. And so at the end of the day, Mr. President is again stepping on separation of powers. Congress has the right to work in this arena. The states have the rights. He does not. And because of that, we have responded to his unlawful and unconstitutional executive order with a lawsuit. I am co-leading with California, and we just filed a preliminary injunction motion. And we will continue to fight that. We are confident we're going to prevail because, again, it's not about the merits of his contentions. We're talking about whether what he is trying to do, he's doing it lawfully.
We've only touched on a couple of the lawsuits that you filed. They range. You're challenging the executive power given to Elon Musk, trying to stop tariffs on goods from Mexico, Canada, and China, and the termination of nearly $12 billion in public health grants. But lots of questions about enforcement. The next question I have is from Everett George of Fallon, who's wondering what happens next.
Hello, Attorney General Ford. I was wondering what's the running list of laws and rights the current administration has violated? And why does there appear to be such a hesitancy to speak about it in those binding terms? Every day, the president brags of enforcement, but operates without any fear of pushback against his own violations. So what should be done to correct this?
Everett, I appreciate that question. And look, I think you're right. We have currently joined or co-leading 15, I think is the last count, multi-state lawsuits against Trump and his administration and their actions since the president has entered office. We are very discerning in when we sue and what we sue about. He has signed probably upwards of 100 executive orders, and I've not sued over every single one of them. But the 15 that we've signed on are, again, because they are unlawful and they are negatively affecting the battles. What we have done is gone to court, and the courts have agreed with us. We have not lost one lawsuit that we have filed. That should say something. People want to act like it's about partisanship or politics, but when the fact of the matter is, I sued Biden. When Biden violated the law on mifepristone and his FDA, I sued him and prevailed in that lawsuit. These are lawsuits rooted in the rule of law. And the president talks about the rule of law all the time, and he talks about law and order all the time, but all he's bringing is chaos. And what we are doing is going to court, defending the rule of law, and we are prevailing. So whether it's the birthright citizenship case I just talked about, whether it's trying to restrict trillions of dollars of monies that have already been allocated and directed to be spent by Congress, we went to court to defeat that. Whether it's trying to lay off probationary workers without giving them the process that the statutes require, we have sued them against that and got people their jobs back. These are the types of things that we are doing right now every single day and defending the rights and the rule of law. To be sure, he will continue to press the envelope. I have confidence in our systems of government, including the Supreme Court.
How do you still have confidence in the system? Trump is not following due process. You saw the courts tell him to return the person that he unlawfully detained to El Salvador, and he's not listening. I know that your role is more the lawsuits, but kind of how do you make sure that he follows through, that he listens to them?
Yeah, look, it's difficult. I'm not going to sit here and act like we are in a circumstance where we can have 100% certainty in our systems. But I retain that level of confidence. I understand that Mr. Trump has seemingly pushed back, even to the extent to where the Supreme Court has had to be engaged. But the fight isn't over. We have filed injunctions that have sometimes inadvertently been violated, but sometimes purposely violated. And we've gone back to court and we've gotten those injunctions enforced. And the Trump administration has complied. We have to continue to believe and pursue the avenues available to us, which incidentally also includes the people continuing to voice their opposition to violations of the rule of law.
We've also gotten a number of questions regarding your role as the state's top law enforcement officer. This one is from Philip Cooney, a KUNR listener.
My question is, will he pursue state charges against Michelle Fiore for her election corruption in the 2020 election? President Trump granted Michelle a pardon for the federal corruption charges against her, but still leaves it open for AG Ford as state charges.
Well, I appreciate the question, and I'm sure you won't appreciate my response because we do not speak on actions that we may or may not take from a prosecutorial side of things or even in litigation. So I won't be able to answer that question for you. What I will say is, as with every single case, we analyze the facts. We look at limitations on prosecutions, which include, for example, statutes of limitation that may apply to certain actions and make determinations on how we might best proceed. No one is above the law, which is why, again, I've sued President Trump 15 times.
Similar question along those same lines. I'll go ahead and play this next question from another KUNR listener, Patrick Hamilton of Sparks.
My question is, in the 2020 election, we had several people that were considered fake electors. Is it your plan to prosecute those that were involved?
Patrick, this is a question I actually can answer, because we have, in fact, a public record of having already attempted to prosecute these individuals. We are in the Supreme Court right now. We filed charges against those six so-called fake electors in December of 2 years ago, and the Clark County Court disagreed with us filing it in that venue, and we are in the Supreme Court right now challenging that determination. But we have also filed charges against those six individuals in Carson City in the event the Supreme Court agrees with the district court in Clark County. So we will pursue justice.
The state legislature is renewing efforts to make being a fake elector a felony. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I testified in support of Skip Daley's bill a couple of years ago. I do think that these are serious charges and there should be a law that addresses those directly. The current law on the books does not directly address these issues, just like, for example, in price fixing. There's nothing that directly addresses price fixing in the essential goods and services. That's just an analogy I'm trying to draw for you to understand in this regard. So I would certainly welcome a law that directly addresses fake electors.
And last question, you are terming out as Attorney General. Will you run for Nevada governor in 2026?
Well, look, I am sitting in my office here in Las Vegas, Nevada, and won't speak on the political side of things. I think that, however, there are enough headlines out there and statements that I've made that can answer that question.
That was Nevada Democratic Attorney General Aaron Ford. I'm Lucia Starbuck, and you've been listening to Purple Politics Nevada.